Hey, I've got a riddle for you. What did Sitting Bull say when he saw Custer coming towards the little bighorn? Give up?
Here come the colonel.
Not funny.
All right, welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host, I'm Colonel Mason. We're going to get back to our interview with Kibo Storke here in just a minute. Telling about funding renewable energy sources. And he's going to explain to us a little later on in the program why it is so difficult getting funding for renewable energy sources in third world countries. And this brings me to remind you about the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference of 2012. It's going on October 21st through the 24th in Seattle, Washington, at the Renaissance Seattle Hotel. You can find more information about it at IEEEGHTC.org. That's IEEE, and then Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, GHTC.org. So if you have any solutions, that's a good place for you. And of course, at the end of the program, listener comments are the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have right here on the set. Get into our coin jar here and toss in a little bit of money and get an answer to today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Yes, I see. We have summoned the spirit of the fountain because we threw in the coins. The spirit who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. All right, oh, spirit of the fountain, tell us this now. How old did a teenager in Tehran have to be to vote in Iran's 201 presidential election? A teenager in Iran could vote in 2001 in the presidential election, but how old did that teenager have to be?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
The old spirit of the fountain comes through for us once again. A Tehrani teenager, that would be a teenager in Tehran, Iran, only had to be age 15 to vote in the 2001 presidential election. All right, there's your little bit of useless information out of the fountain of useless information. Okay, here we go. Let's go back to our guest.
And we've been talking largely about wind, but you'd also, we touched on solar, and of course wind and solar have similar similar drawbacks and similar attributes. I mean, the sun only shines a certain amount of the time, too, so it's got to rely on storage, and it doesn't create electricity when it's too cloudy outside and that sort of thing. So we're talking about renewables. You do all sorts of renewables. What other sort of renewables would be viable other than wind and solar?
Well, right now, the problem with other types of renewable technologies like biomass and geothermal is that they're mostly small in scale. And again, I go back to, because I'm in the project financing world, Colonel, the issue is that the money doesn't get behind these things because, well, they're not really used to them. They're not really familiar with how they work and how they get financed and the predictability of them in a long-term basis, because it's just like anything else. It's new technology. It hasn't been around for a long time. And let me give you, for instance, a turbine needs to be up and going for 10 years before, a lot of you banks will invest in that technology. They want to know that this thing has been around, it's been spinning, it has maintenance records, it has warranties, it has performance records. It's not that way with geothermal. It's not that way with biomass. It may be that way with biomass in Germany, for instance, like the anaerobic digestion, and it's been around for a long time over there. But in the United States, kind of new. And so everything really depends, Colonel, on the money and the acceptance of the money to invest in these newer technologies. And unfortunately, as we all know, our economic situation causes a lot of us to be cautious. And so we go back to what we know. So wind has been around for a decade, maybe more. We have second and third generations of wind projects here coming up, retirement of turbines. And then in solar, solar's been around for, 10, 15 years, and the panels have been proven, and there's big projects on a global basis and on the United States basis. So It really boils down to the money.
Yeah, money is it, isn't it? That seems to be the answer to all the things that we're doing, certainly in a capitalistic society like the one that we're living in, certainly. And that's your specialty. But what about, you know, these people are saying, hey, look, natural gas. That's we used to burn it off, and we're still burning it off in some areas, but that's coming on really strong. And you know, as soon as we get over these fracking scares and get people feeling a little bit better about how we're going to harvest the natural gas, that we've got a you know, even the most dire people predict a 100-year supply. Some say 200, even 300-year supply if we do it correctly. Isn't the coming of natural gas going to take all these renewables that we've been working on over the past 30 or 40 years and kind of put them back in the back burner again, back as what happened before when fossil fuels became cheap?
It may. It may do that. And I think my personal view on that is that natural gas is the new green. And I think that is a baseload as a clean burning power source, and the technologies around the burning and the processing of that, and the EPA laws in relation to the emissions make that a very viable product for our country. And with the discovery of all these different, shales and whatnot, and the natural gas deposits that we have, it's a very, very viable, actually 1-2 punch for a base load of natural gas and a renewable source on top of that. Because we still have these surface facilities that we can still utilize for solar and wind and others. And, I don't think that renewables will go away. I think that natural gas, is one of these things that's going to be a very nice base load that would augment and maybe, hopefully, even be able to replace something like coal, which would be phenomenal. But it still boils down to our infrastructure, right? So we don't have the pipelines. We don't have the transmission lines. We don't have a lot of the different technologies that would make a natural gas plant in a smaller scale and or big scale work efficiently. Well, now we have certainly big, large gas plants that have been around for a long time. But there's a new technology out there from a project financing perspective and in a new initiative called microgrids, and they are natural gas projects and or others that are between, 20 megawatts and 100 megawatts. And these things can actually be used for a corporation for their own power. And these are some of the things that I'm very excited in personally to be working on, because I see that as kind of like one of the newer frontiers here. And so I don't know if that answers your question on natural gas, but I see a hybrid of distributed generation technologies coming to bear,
right,
that can allow us on a regional, city, and even corporation level to almost basically chart our own destiny in relation to our own power.
Well, you made a good point. I mean, the pipelines aren't in place, but we do have rail lines in place that can move massive amounts of coal, and so the coal-fired furnaces looks like they're not going to go away anytime soon, at least not until we get these other pipelines in place. But then you brought up the microgrids, and that's a very interesting thing, because what you're saying is that if local areas decide they want to do their own electrical production, that natural gas and solar and wind and all these other renewables, that might be a major contributor to solving our energy problems. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I am. I don't know if it would be the major panacea to solve everything, but it's certainly, from a short-term perspective, it's easier than standing up a 200 to 300 megawatt natural gas plant where you can just do one that's 30 to 60, because you're not gonna, it's the same thing, you're not gonna plow big lines for transmission lines, you don't have to connect to huge utilities, you just connect it to a corporation, right? So a data center or a fab or something that's a huge consumer of power, electrons, you would connect a microgrid to.
Well, of course, that would, you know, if that was done widely, it would eliminate maybe the need of a whole bunch of new transmission lines altogether. And if that's the case, then, of course, you're seeing wind and solar taking a hit on that, too. Of course, the question immediately comes to mind is how do you move the natural gas to these microgrids? Because you'd have to do that. You'd have to get them locally to the microgrid. Would you do it the same way that we're doing propane now and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't really know the answer, but what I do know from a cost perspective is you have to have a kind of a team that has the ability to look at the geographical approach and the structural resources approach and say, okay, here's a substation, here's water, here's power, here's load, and that's where I'm going to locate this microgrid. So, I mean, you couldn't do it in, you know, West Texas to service Dallas, obviously. That doesn't work. I got to put this microgrid right where I have resources right now, and so it's not something that we can just, if in fact we, you know, had the policy all done and all that, the technology is, by the way, there, but if you kind of did a wave of a magic wand, you couldn't just roll out in the United States. You'd have to look at the existing infrastructure and locate your microgrid where it made the most sense.
All right, and these microgrids, you see these as being solutions in, let's say, humanitarian areas where third world countries, or we don't say that anymore, we say developing countries, don't have an infrastructure. I mean, could these things move around worldwide? And do you see investors in your particular circle of investors being interested in supplying those sorts of things?
There's two points to that question. It's a very good question. I think that the microgrid is very much a solution for developing countries. So, again, the technology's there, and obviously, you know, especially island nations and whatnot that need this kind of thing, they have some very interesting projects going on in relation to that. The problem with the money side is that, you know, again, we're in a kind of a conservative nature investment perspective right now, and so from a project financing perspective, I've seen projects in island nations that perhaps the socioeconomic situation is not ideal, and so the money's not going to play, and so the project doesn't get done. So basically, from an investment perspective, it's got to be done by the country, right? They got to come up with the money, they got to believe in it, and they got to get behind it. And if they do, then, yeah, it's very viable. I mean, any island nation, Puerto Rico, you know, the Caribbean islands, Hawaii, for that matter, in essence, they are microgrids, right? They're existing microgrids. They built their infrastructure around that little teeny population base. And, you know, they need to, you know, implement technologies that can bring them more efficient power at less cost, and get off of the coal or the naphtha. In Hawaii, it's obviously a very big, you know, the Hawaiian utility companies are really shipping companies, because all they do is they ship naphtha to, you know, Hawaii, and they use that to power the islands. And so there's a shift moving to look at the natural resources that are available, for instance, back to Hawaii. That is there. So we've got 20 years of eucalyptus trees that have been around, replaced the pineapple and the sugar cane, and they can be used for biomass, right? You've got incredible geothermal on the Big Island. You've got incredible wind. You've got incredible solar. So you have all these incredible assets on this island that can be used as a microgrid, and it's really bringing the right people together with the right vision who have the venture capital funding behind them to develop these kinds of projects, because they take a long time, a lot of heavy lifting, but they are really exciting and incredible projects. And my hat's off to all the people that are developers and entrepreneurs out there that live that world. So I'm very proud of them and really privileged to work with them.
Yeah. Well, that, of course, that begs the question: are you involved with financing projects then in Hawaii, or you just happen to know these people because they're like colleagues of yours?
Well, you know, Kimo is a Hawaiian name, and I grew up in Hawaii, so obviously my heart goes to Hawaii, and I do think, yes, so answer your question, yes, I'm involved in projects in Hawaii.
Okay, well, that's cool. Getting back to this humanitarian thing again, it seems to me and to a number of different people that if natural gas in the United States continues to push renewables to the back burner, there's a less and less and less a chance for doing it. That really renewables have got the great future in these developing nations, and you're saying that's the case as long as the developing nations are secure politically. Like, it could be chancy going into the Congo, because right at the moment, last I heard, the northern Congo was in some sort of a war. And so to be able to have your investors or anybody else interested in doing these things, they're not going to do it as long as the countries are not stable. And so the individual countries themselves have got to invest in these renewables. Is that what you're saying? And then to carry the question even further, would you help arrange that financing? Would that be something that you could do out of KAS Consulting Group?
Right. So to answer your question, yes. I think the country has to take responsibility for their own power, especially if there is an issue with the socioeconomic world there, and they have to, be able to assure even their own investors that nothing's going to happen to that power plant. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example here, and this is actually ironically in Hawaii. There has been, even in Austin, Texas here, that we've seen it. There are thieves out there that go out there and they pull up all the cable, all the copper, and they just totally steal it from these remote power places.
Sure.
And that is happening now in the United States, and I have no reason to believe that it won't happen in other areas. Once, unfortunately, people figure out they can make money off of, taking things that aren't theirs, and they're doing it right now with solar farms, it's going to happen. So, back to the government approach, I think that, I've seen some initiatives here that are very, very encouraging in relation to not just power, but agriculture and community development. Right, and then ultimately, the well-being of people in the community, if they feel like they're the owners of the energy project, right? So let's just call it a solar farm, and you've employed the people around to build it, and you've done a community model whereby the people take care of it, and you've got employment. Then you know what? People feel ownership, and they're going to take care of it. The township will do that. And even one step further in the biomass world, so this is happening in Hawaii as well, there are initiatives where you have people coming together from an agricultural perspective, from a technology perspective, and from a community perspective to enhance the community by providing not only the agriculture needed for biomass, right, so the growing and the tilling of the crop, to the delivery of the crop to the biomass facility, to the workings of the biomass facility, and then the usage of the power on a community level. And so there are some very, very encouraging, like I said, initiatives going on globally and in the United States in relation to this whole, call it a microgrid community, of improving people's lives by utilizing power as a way to, build sustainable and, ongoing community involvement, which give people jobs and ultimately give people hope.
Well, that's an interesting point you make. Not only have to worry about the stable governments and warfare and all that sort of thing in the developing countries, you got to worry about the thieves going out and digging up the copper and the lines, like happens really here in the United States too. Now, I was talking to Tina yesterday, your friend that does websites, and she's working with you on a new website. Could you explain that a little bit for us?
Oh yeah, Tina. Tina's a great friend, and we're working on. I own a couple of URLs: Green Energy Marketing. .com and Green Energy Leasing, and these are just places where we're working on a blog together. We're going to have different CEOs of green energy companies talking about who they are, what they do, and why is it important. And we think that the proliferation of messages from CEOs is a very wise thing, but it also helps them on a bit of a promotion / PR perspective. But the more people know about how corner office is thinking and what they're doing, I think the more, visibility that everybody gets in relation to the proliferation of green energy, on a global basis.
All right, Kimo, I want you to kind of put on the meditation cap for just a minute and step into your own little meditation chamber there and give us a prediction for the future. What is a profound prediction do you see 5 years out, 10 years out, 50 years out, whatever? Give us a prediction.
Yeah, I think that the ingenuity of and intelligence of man is going to come up to par with what we have and we need in our world. I continue to be amazed, like I said, at the intellectual capital that's out there that's being put forth into the world of green energy and energy in general. And so I'm encouraged that within 10 years we're going to see the proliferation of storage. We're going to see kind of microgrids and macrogrids in the same space. We're going to see different types of technology coalesce with each other, right? And so we're going to see wind, solar, biomass, all in one little fall swoop. And hopefully, and I'm very encouraged about this too, we're going to see revival in relation to communities and people working together, because we're going to, put together these communities of power based on commonality in relation to building a community that we can actually touch and control.
All right, Kimo Storkey, the CEO and brilliant brains behind KAS Consulting Group out of Austin, Texas. So good of you to be with us today and generous with your time and really generous with your insights. We appreciate you very much, and I hope you'll come back and visit us again from time to time.
Thank you, Colonel, and it's a privilege talking to everybody, and look forward to maybe some follow-up conversation.
Okay, with that, if you want to know more about financing renewables, or if you have renewables that need financing, check out the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference 2012, going on October 21st to the 24th in Seattle, Washington. You can find out more about them at IEEEGHTC.org. That's IEEEGHTC. .org. Bring your solutions, engineering, science, technology, and a broad range. All these things going on over there, power infrastructures, off-grid power, renewables, sustainable energy, all these things. So check them out. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
The current thing that I think is very important and which needs attention urgently and isn't as widely recognized as it needs to be, is that the United States is not the only place in the world that can do technology development now. When the rest of the world was in ruins after the Second World War, we were the only game in town. And having very high tax rates and unfriendly policies towards capital, we could get away with because there was no alternative. Now there is an alternative, and we are losing it fast. We're losing capital investment, we're losing initial public offerings, and Washington does not seem to get this. This is just as urgent as the financial problems in the U.S. Our addiction to affluence and entitlement and everything else is causing us to lose our leadership, and that would be a shame. We still have the best scientists, the best inventions, but if they aren't converted to jobs here, shame on us. Skip Rung, President and Executive Director of Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.